For the second part of our program, Dr. Skip Burris and Dr. Dan Hayes responded to cases presented by our community oncology panel, beginning with a patient from the practice of Dr. Atif Hussain.
My patient is a 67-year-old woman diagnosed with 2.2-centimeter poorly differentiated infiltrating ductal carcinoma. She underwent a lumpectomy and sentinel lymph node, followed by a complete dissection. The margins negative. She was found to have 4 out of 11 nodes involved by carcinoma, including the 2 sentinel lymph nodes. ER 100% positive, PR 50% positive, Ki 67 28%, HER2 new by FISH testing 1.6, aneuploid a tumor. A few months before the diagnosis, she had a bone density and her T-score was minus 2, and they placed her around 6 to 7 months before the diagnosis on Fosamax once weekly.
What about the lady herself? What was her lifestyle like and her overall health?
She's doing very well. She's a retired nurse. She knows a lot about this. There was no family history of breast cancer. Therefore, to her, this was a shock. She has been having yearly mammograms on time. They were all negative until the one she had at this illness. No medical problems. All organ function are preserved.
And what was her lifestyle like?
Very active, scuba diving and traveling.
Are there any clinical trials she might have been eligible for?
Yes, there was one. We were doing the BCIRG 005 and 006. 005, which is the HER2-new negative, and 006, the HER2-new positive. Because she was negative for HER2-new, she was eligible for the Breast Cancer International Research Group 005 study.
And that randomization?
To either AC followed by Taxotere or TEC, Taxotere Adriacytoxin.
Okay. So, Dan, let's dissect out the issue in terms of both chemotherapy and hormonal therapy, and let's start with the chemotherapy.
So, to me, actually, this is relatively straightforward. I would say if you just plugged her into something like Adjuvant Online, I think you'd find that she, in the absence of any therapy, has a 60 to 70% chance of recurrence over the next 10 years. And if you plug in the benefits of hormone therapy, which I will take as a given, we'll do that later, but that would probably reduce that to the order of 45 to 50% risk of recurrence. And even if you figure that ER and PR are relatively negative predictive factors for chemotherapy, so that perhaps you get a 20% reduction instead of a 30% reduction, and I'm making that up, but I think that's close, you still have probably an 8 to 10% absolute benefit with adjuvant chemotherapy, and that exceeds my cutoff, and I suspect everybody in this room's cutoff for what you would recommend to an otherwise healthy woman.
What specific chemotherapy would you offer or consider to this woman?
As we all know, there are a variety of regimens, and the overview suggests that something with adriamycin or an anthracycline, it doesn't have to be adriamycin, is better than something without, not a lot, but in this lady's case, because her prognosis is relatively poor, that gets amplified. And certainly something with a taxane. At the San Antonio meetings, we heard the first report of the Eastern Oncology Group study comparing docetaxel versus paclitaxel, and they appear to be identical. And so I actually don't think it matters which of those you choose, except for your own personal perception of toxicity. Personally, I preferred paclitaxel, but I think that's cultural. It's because I grew up in the U.S. intergroup, and we have tended to use paclitaxel as our standard of care for everything. So I personally would offer her, outside of a trial, 4 cycles of doxorubicin and cyclophosphamide, followed by 4 cycles of paclitaxel. And I personally would recommend it be given in the dose-dense fashion. Again, from my standpoint, I'm not convinced that dose-dense is better than not dose-dense. I am convinced it's shorter, and I'm pretty convinced it's equally or perhaps slightly less toxic, except for the anemia. And so with the opportunity to cut 8 weeks of therapy off of a patient's course with the same outcomes, to me, it's a preferable approach.
What about the issue of the fact that the tumor is ER positive and the question of dose dense and ER positive versus, say, a regimen like TAC?
Well, so then I think we're starting to compare retrospective subgroup analyses of predictive factors between studies, and I can't imagine a better way to come up with false positive observations than doing that. So personally, I think we really don't have evidence that one regimen is better than another in given subsets. I think the trial 05 that you discussed should get to that because it's asking precisely that question, whether or not giving combination chemotherapy is better than giving it sequentially. And it's not going to be sufficiently powered, again, to do a subset analysis by ER positive or negative, but I think it'll be there. In the next Oxford overview, we've all agreed that in addition to looking at classic outcomes and looking at hormone therapy outcomes based on ER, we're also going to look at chemotherapy outcomes based on not just ER, but we're going to try to get as much data as we can with the other markers. Those aren't routinely done by all the cooperative groups, so they aren't absolutely available, but at least we can begin to accumulate this, and I think we can get to those answers sooner than later. If you said you like tack off a trial better than sequential therapy, I wouldn't argue. I don't think that's a bad regimen at all. I think it's a very good regimen. If you said you like AC followed by a taxane and you prefer docetaxel, I wouldn't argue with that either. Personally, in my clinic, outside a trial, I would offer her dose-dense AC followed by dose-dense paclitaxel.
Skip?
I agree with Dan's assessments on her risk for recurrence. And as Dr. Hussain mentioned, the BCRG-005 trial is actually the discussion we would get into on or off study. I am swayed by the data you brought up about the lack of positivity for the paclitaxel trials. And similar to Dan's cultural predisposition toward the intergroup trials, I've participated in a number of the docetaxel trials. And I think it is interesting that it's not just a dose-dense trial, but the series of trials that didn't show a benefit in the ER-positive subgroup for the paclitaxel arms. And so this patient in my clinic would get TAC with Neulasta support, and that would be my first choice for her outside of doing the clinical trial, swayed by the fact that she's ER-positive, and the benefit was just as large in that group as it was in the overall population in the TAC versus FAC study.
Neil, may I ask, when is this likely to be published?
A couple months. Why? You want to tell some late-breaking ASCO stuff?
Yes.
Go for it.
Okay. And I would like to invite all of you to be discreet, but in CLGB 9344, which is Craig Henderson's AC paclitaxel versus no paclitaxel trial, we prospectively collected tissues from all those patients, and of the 3,200 patients in the intergroup, we got tissues on 2,800, so we did pretty well. If any of you contributed, thank you very much. We have done a bit of a soft shoe dance. Rather than testing all 2,800 blocks, we split them into virtual lots of 750 patients each balanced on all the things you'd like to balance it on, nodes, ER, PR, and the randomization that they were in. So we pulled out 750 blocks and stained them for HER2. And we stained them, by the way, in every way you'd like to have HER2 stained, but let's just assume all the assays are the same. What I'm going to be presenting at ASCO this year, looking at two of these sets, and the results are identical, so that's reassuring. I think we're on the right track here, is that no matter what your original prognosis was, and remember all those patients were node positive, that the ER-positive, HER2-negative patients don't seem to benefit from the addition of paclitaxel. The HER2-positive patients benefited from paclitaxel regardless of their ER status, by the way. They got more benefit if they're ER-negative. If they're ER-positive, though, and HER2-positive, there's a benefit from paclitaxel versus nil. But if you're ER-positive and HER2-negative, the curves are absolutely overlapping. That needs to be validated, and I'm not sure I would take that home, and in fact, I would not take it home and apply it in my clinic yet, and I'll be saying that from the podium. But I think this is where the field is going, and if we can get enough of these kinds of data, I believe we can begin to individualize therapy more.
No, that's fascinating. I was just going to ask Skip, same exact case, ER negative, still use TAC?
Yes, it wouldn't give me a reason to switch. I have not widely adopted the dose-dense and, in fact, have not given it to a patient outside of a clinical trial scenario. And I do buy into the fact that with the Neupogen support and some of the Neulasta data coming out of Dana-Farber, that it's probably less toxic and equally efficacious. But having chosen docetaxel as my preferred taxane, based mostly off of efficacy data from the metastatic trials and the results of the TAC-FAC study, that would still be the direction I'd lean.
And what's the thinking behind that? Why, in general, you haven't jumped on board with those stents?
No particular reason. I think that the idea of giving those drugs more frequently makes sense. I certainly buy some of Dr. Norton's arguments. I was convinced that weekly paclitaxel was better than Q3 weeks. So going to 2 weeks, I have joked, was a step in the wrong direction. But I think that the E1199 trial results don't surprise me. Weekly paclitaxel looked a little better. The taxotere, docetaxel every 3 weeks looked a little better. Probably the trial needed to have some modifications for growth factor support and breaks from the weekly therapy.
Okay, let's turn to hormonal therapy. Again, Dan, 67-year-old woman, 4 positive nodes, ER 100% positive, PR 50% positive, but she has a T-score of -2.
So independent of predictive factors other than the fact that she's hormone receptor positive, I'm not sure we can pick the best way to treat her specifically. As everyone in this room knows, every trial now comparing an aromatase inhibitor versus tamoxifen, whether it's up front after 2 or 3 years or after 5 years with an aromatase inhibitor versus placebo, has been positive. None of them has been very positive, and none of them has been positive for overall survival, with the exception of subgroup analyses in MA17. It is likely that one or more of those is going to have a positive survival benefit at the next ASCO meeting as well, but we don't know that. That's if you just take all comers, all patients. I think you could argue that that small added benefit of an AI in a patient with a worse prognosis, with arguably the more effective therapy, that being hormone therapy versus chemotherapy. It's interesting how much we argue over chemotherapy. In this lady's case, the hormone therapy is probably going to do her a lot more good than the chemotherapy. I would offer this woman an AI, even in the knowledge that she has osteopenia, and again, I would continue her on some sort of bisphosphonate. I know there are data that it's the ER-positive, PR-negative patients who are more likely to benefit from an AI than the ER-positive, PR-positives. But in this lady's case, given a relatively poor prognosis, I would err on the side of treating her with the more effective drug. If she were node-negative, for example, I might not. And which of the three AIs I would choose, I think, is dealer's choice. As far as I can tell, you can't slip a playing card between the three of them, at least in terms of efficacy or reported side effects.
Skip, agree, disagree, or in between?
Agree. I think that this is actually an interesting patient. If the trials emerged that showed from some of the randomized letrozole trial that it was worthwhile giving a couple years of tamoxifen before giving an AI, it would be nice to know that if a patient like this who had osteopenia, and this would be a patient that I would follow the bone density scores a little bit and maybe push in the direction of going to an IV bisphosphonate if I felt like she was getting worse in that regard while she was on the AI.
The so-called Big 98 trial, for which you've all seen the first randomization, which was letrozole versus tamoxifen up front. The second part of that was a sequencing question, which is addressing exactly what you said. And again, it's very likely we'll see the results of that also this spring, at least the first results. That's not for sure, but they've suggested that they may release those data. So,
you want to follow up with what happened with the patient, Dr. Hussain?
Yes, she asked me about tamoxifen. What about me being on tamoxifen for a couple of years since I just started the Fosamax, maybe my bones can improve? And she told me, are you sure that the benefit from anti-estrogen, is it additive, or is it you pick the best drug from the beginning and you get the benefit more than any other sequence, which we don't know that in terms of overall survival? I placed her on aromatase inhibitor. I told her she has 4 positive nodes, her risk is very high, and I pretended that I knew how to treat bone. And she's on calcium and vitamin D, and we will check her bone density in another year and take it from there. But she's on aromatase inhibitor.
What about the issue of selection of AIs? What we've heard in general from clinical researchers is, quote, follow the data, that the longest follow-up in the initial upfront adjuvant setting is with attack and anastrozole, so use anastrozole, maybe letrozole, so switching exemestane, although, yeah, there's data for Arimidex. After 5 years, letrozole, though again, there's data for anastrozole.
It's a class of drugs that really isn't too dissimilar from the antidepressants, and the fact that in the heat of the battle in the clinic during the day, and because of the cost of the drugs, there's that feeling like you should give the first month away for free. It's a prescription of what's there, and I think some doctors have individual biases, but I can tell you that it really is all over the map in our clinic. I think we all know the data. We all know how to answer the question and say from the outgo what the anastrozole is, if you're going to switch to use letrozole, et cetera, but I know in our practice it really is all over the place.
Let me just pin you down a little bit more, Skip. What kind of postmenopausal patient would you start tamoxifen on, if any?
Postmenopausal patient that I would start tamoxifen on, I think toward the lower risk of recurrence, with maybe not the level of estrogen benefit, for example, this patient did, where I was very concerned about osteopenia. So you give me a patient who's node negative or comes up with a score where I know I'm going to give them hormonal therapy, I know there's a benefit there, but it's not the magnitude of a benefit for a patient like this, and there's something about her that gives me that osteopenic feel. I'm a 2-year for some of those and then follow with an AI, and I've done that. That probably fits into 1 in 10 or 15 of my patients, so not many.
Okay, well, let's move away from people who give you the osteopenic feel. Any other patients you start tamoxifen on?
From the outset?
Yep.
not that hit me. I mean, I think I've had some patients that have been unable to take the AIs for bone and joint problems. And so within a few months, we've switched back to tamoxifen, but not from the get-go.
Dan?
I'd almost turn the question around, and that is, which patients would I give an AI to? And I put it that way on purpose. I think the poor prognosis, anybody who's node positive and ER positive, I think the amplification is sufficient. I'm not sure of these data, but I believe that HER2 positivity will predict for a higher benefit of an AI over tamoxifen. That's probably in the absence of trastuzumab. In the presence of trastuzumab, I don't know, and neither does anybody else in the world. And that'll be an interesting set of discoveries, given the fact that the Baylor group has suggested that trastuzumab plus tamoxifen in their model turns tamoxifen back into an antiestrogen in HER2-positive patients. But right now, if I have a HER2-positive patient, I tend to err on the side of an AI. In node-negative patients who are either normal or have any osteopenia and have no increased risk of stroke or clot problems, I tend to start tamoxifen in those patients now, unless they want an AI.
2.5 centimeters?
So if it's a postmenopausal 2.5 centimeter ER positive, node negative patient.
HER2 negative.
HER2 negative. I would say tamoxifen is my drug of choice. If you'd like an AI, there's nothing wrong with that. My colleague next door would probably give you an AI, but I would start with tamoxifen. With the provisos, Skip said, I mean, it seems like we're getting more data from all of these trials every 6 months. And I think that patient, one can probably afford to wait a couple of years. I mean, it's not like TAM's a bad drug. It's a great drug. And see what kind of increasing long-term data we get.
So you're probably one out of three, one out of four patients getting tamoxifen. Just
probably,
doing the math,
yeah.
There. Something like that.
Yeah. That's fair.
Lowell?
I have a little trouble with that just personally because, I mean, I think we put in our group about 150 patients on ATAC. And if I knowingly put a woman on the arm that was inferior on ATAC, even though it's not a survival loss, and tamoxifen's going 0 for 4, 0 for 5 against the AIs, you know, I was persuaded a little bit by that data that Tony Howell showed where there is a relapse difference in that first 2 years in the women on the tamoxifen arm, the other arm. So, I mean, I would agree, we certainly use it, I think, in our practice in the lower risk women that have osteopenia, can't afford it, and other things like that, but our default position is an AI.
This concludes the second CD. For more from Meet the Professors, please turn to the third CD.